Good morning. I'm your host, Claudia Shambaugh, welcoming you to the November 16th, 2021 edition of Ask a Leader. Today, we'll start with the latest draft maps of congressional, state senate, state assembly districts with Commissioner Linda Akutagawa of the California Citizens Redistricting Commission. The nuances are as abundant as are the final days of deliberation. And if you don't know your legislative district maps, you're missing out. I'm put the link up on our promotion on the website. I'll put it also up, the We Draw the Lines link, on my podcast summary later today. In the second segment is Sharir Masri, air quality researcher, author, and climate change activist, looking at what was achieved or not achieved at COP26 in Glasgow these last several weeks. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the show. Returning is my first guest, Commissioner Linda Akutagawa of Huntington Beach, one of the 14 commissioners of California's Citizens Redistricting Commissioners, to bring us up to date on where the California redistricting process is drawing the boundaries of the congressional, state senate, state assembly, and state board of equalization districts will be located. This is following the most recent release of visualizations of these districts, the final round of community outreach leading up to the submission to the California Secretary of State on December 27th. Commissioner Akutagawa is from Huntington Beach. She is a no-party preference. She's president and CEO of Leadership Education for Asian Pacifics and chairs the Alliance for Board Diversity and is an appointed member of the California Department of Insurance Diversity Task Force, is a member of the Asian American Institute Advisory Board at California State University at Los Angeles, as well as board member of the Asian Pacific Planning and Policy Council. She comes to us today from her office in Huntington Beach in the middle of a commission meeting. I'm so glad she's with us. Welcome back. I believe it's the fourth round here on Ask Leader. Welcome back, Commissioner Linda Akutagawa.
Well, thank you very much for having me again, Claudia. I really appreciate it.
Well, you are the one for all the inquiring minds to find out about where we are with this visualization underway, the upcoming hearings. It looks like now, since we talked at the end of September, it must be palpable there's a considerable uptick in engagement, not to mention a little bit of panic. So are you getting more and more, is this more and more palpable? Is this starting to get exhausting for you?
It's not exhausting, and it's exciting in the sense that the uptick is definitely felt. We're getting a lot more public engagement in the form of inputs and comments about the draft maps that we just put out. And we've already made it clear to everybody, you know, these are drafts, and there's still time and room for additional changes that will be made. These are by no means final. And so, you know, this is a great time for, you know, anyone who's interested in this to view the draft maps, to send in their input to us. And there's many ways in which they can provide their feedback and input on the maps. Most importantly, what I want to encourage people to tell us is, if they like something, why do they like it? If they don't like something, why don't they like it? What would they want to see different? And also keeping in mind the six criteria that we have to follow in order of priority, equal population being number one. And that's the one that I think is the most challenging. If they want to remove a city and insert another city, well, then they'll have to think about, if they put in a city that's smaller, then they got to put out an equal amount of population, unless the standard deviation, like it's a little bit over the standard deviation. And they'll see all this information on the draft maps. But this is the kind of input that would be so helpful. You know, we really want to hear from the public. And there's not only the in the form of via email or via the map feedback forms that are on our website. There is also the ability to call in and give public comment. I know we just, this is literally hot off the press. We did just have a conversation that the appointment times for anybody to give us public comment filled up quickly. We are revising the appointment time so that we can try to accommodate more people. I think it's great because it means that there's so many people that want to engage, that want to tell us what they think. This is great. It just means that, you know, Californians are engaging and we want to encourage that. And so we're going to be trying to rework the appointment time so that we can add more people in. And I would just encourage everybody, keep an eye out, get onto our mailing list because we'll be putting an announcement out via the newsletter. Or get onto our social media. There'll be announcements on social media of when new appointment times will open up so that then people can jump on it and get themselves an appointment. If they don't get an appointment, that doesn't mean that they're going to be prevented from giving public comment. They can. They just will just may have to wait a little bit longer, but we will still take their public comment.
We draw the lines as the website folks, and that it's very clear on the social media how to pull up the legit, not something else. But so I'm glad you made the distinction when you talked about revising appointment times. It's an expansion. You talked about that adding on. So that's really helpful. So although there is drama up in the San Joaquin County vicinity, it grew. There's more. I mean, I'm sure COVID's shuffled a lot of people away from more populated areas, and that's a COVID result, I'm going to guess, among others. But I want to focus today's interview with Commissioner Akutagawa on the visualizations, the draft maps in Orange County, even mainly Irvine, which I'm hearing a great deal more about from various listeners. So for just to get sort of out of the way, the commission, the redistricting commission, began this whole mapping process with a clean map. You are not at all interested in maintaining existing districts. Is that correct?
Yeah, we decided that we would just start with a clean slate. We didn't work off of existing maps, and we needed to look at where the population changes are. It just made more sense to start that way.
And we can see that in our very backyard here. So Irvine is split up, and you mentioned in at least one, if not the last two interviews, that you saw a line going through the city of Irvine for at least the congressional and state senate districts, the I-5 for what you were hearing in communities of interest. That was one of the six criteria, communities of interest. So there are a lot of people that are puzzling over that. And I try to reach out, Commissioner Akutagawa, to the Irvine Unified School District and some representatives I have some contact with. I haven't heard back from them at the time we're recording this, folks, Monday afternoon on November 15th. But I wanted to find out if you happen to know that largely all the school districts around the state or in your area, since you're coming from Huntington Beach, were school districts an entity that was an important overlay, or it had to be offered by people that were testifying to the commission?
I think what we were looking for is what people were testifying to us. And so I'm thinking back to some of the early communities of interest testimony that we were soliciting at the beginning of the summer. And I think this is the challenge for, I'll just say, us as a commission, but everybody, there's lots of different perspectives on what is a community of interest. And some of the early community of interest testimony that we did receive on Irvine was that there was a difference between the northern parts of Irvine and the more southern parts of Irvine that surround UC Irvine. And then now, as we've gotten closer to the actual maps, and now with the draft maps, I think people who may not have given us input in the early rounds are now coming in and giving us input on the early rounds. And we're hearing different kinds of also input where Irvine should stay whole and united in one, and also other perspectives in which cities Irvine should be with. And again, we're hearing different perspectives, and, you know, we all have a lens in which we're seeing our own communities and, you know, in some cases we may see some things, in other cases someone else may see another thing. And I think that's what we're trying to balance in terms of ensuring that we try to honor as much as we can the inputs and the requests that we're getting from the community members. And so that's why during this public input time period that we're in right now, it is important to hear from all the various members of the community. And sometimes they don't always agree with each other.
Right, right. But I guess it explains the kind of nuances of what a community of interest is, like you're saying. If there's a hierarchy, there's different parameters that, you know, if depends on a household, maybe they're consuming school district services. So their community interest, the school district, rise above maybe some other kind of a cultural setting, like what University of Hills, UC Irvine's population versus the Mellow Roos, huge subdivisions near the Great Park and on the other side of the interstate I-5. So it's like every household, it depends how old it is, what kinds of community interest it mostly associates with. So it's really, really complicated.
Yeah. And please don't get me wrong. I am not saying that, you know, we're prioritizing one or the other. I think there's just a lot of complicated nuances to this. And I just come back to the six criteria.
Yes.
Equal population being number one, all the districts have to be as close to equal population. And so in pursuit of that as a priority, with communities of interest being fourth on the list, VRA being second, and then three, contiguity, and then communities of interest, it could be that if, for example, in this case, Irvine had to be split so that we can achieve the population numbers that we need to achieve in a district, we're looking at where communities of interest is saying, okay, well, if we have to split, this is what we're doing. But we're also, you know, going to be looking at what all of the input coming in and trying to figure out, you know, in some ways, it's kind of like reverse engineering Jenga.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, and I know that on background that the City Council of Irvine will be sending a letter out November 23rd. That, when I read that, I thought that sounds kind of late, but we're going to go over all the dates, folks, so people know where those windows remain open and when they close. But so November 23rd from a City Council is not too late to hear from?
No. We'll be continuing to take communities of input and public input on all of our maps up until they're submitted to the Secretary of State.
Okay. All right. Then I guess people are probably leaning a little bit tighter that you were ahead of time in, you met the mandatory period was going to end on November 15th. You got them all up on November 11th. And there was that, it had to be like there's a 2-week interim period that you've imposed on yourself. So that now in the details that people can follow all the agenda details, I believe on the We Draw the Lines, correct? That's where we'll find the agenda. And then we'll go into the dates here.
Yes. So from the time that we released and we approved and we released the first draft of the maps, we are obligated by law to give 14 days during which we cannot make any changes to the map so that Californians have a chance to provide us with input on that time. Now, I do want to be clear that we chose to complete and approve the draft maps when we did, so that then the last day of the public input schedule could be the day before Thanksgiving. That doesn't mean that people cannot continue to give us input during Thanksgiving, but to be honest, we wanted to make sure that anyone who's following this process, whether they're an advocate, whether they're an individual, whether they're staff and commissioners, we can enjoy a Thanksgiving without worrying about, okay, we need to hold a public input meeting on Thanksgiving Day, especially after the 18 months, 2 years that we've had, where this is probably going to be the first time that many people will have had a chance to get together in well over a year for a holiday. And we wanted to make sure that people could do that. But that doesn't mean, you know, our website, our forms, email is still up and running, and people can still give us input on Thanksgiving Day, on over the weekend, and the commission itself will be meeting again on
Monday after Thanksgiving, and during which time we will have opportunities for any member of the public to give us input if they want to call in and give us input via a phone call.
So for those of you who just tuned in, my guest is California Redistricting Commissioner Linda Akutagawa. She's from Huntington Beach, one of the 14 commissioners that is drafting maps for the Congressional, State Senate, State Assembly, and the Board of Equalization districts. So the dates, so they're all on the We Draw the Lines website, but November 17th through the 20th, the 22nd and the 23rd, those are the next meetings coming up. That's starting this Thursday of the broadcast of this interview. Then the commission alone, you'll be doing meetings. So are they both public and hybrid, person remote, or how do people get in on the meetings with the commission?
Well, anyone can participate again via electronic means, via email. They could send us a letter too. In terms of participation, we're continuing to meet via Zoom.
Okay.
And so there are instances where the commissioners may gather together in person, but it's really hybrid. Some commissioners are also logging in via Zoom, and we're encouraging people to watch the live stream, to follow along on our meetings, and they will also have the opportunity to call in and give public comment at any time during our meetings, during the stated public input, public comment times.
So those are November 29th. The 30th, with a few exceptions, December 1st, 2nd, 6th, 7th, 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, December 21st, 23rd. And the 27th is the final map submission day for the Secretary of State Weber?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, so when I did look at all that, I thought, no, you all didn't get a holiday last year for COVID, and now you aren't all getting holidays in the redistricting 2021 season. So we've got little shrines of these commissioners, folks. So anyway, I want to get to, we've talked about breaking down the different parts of Irvine, and for the Assembly District pretty much captures all of the city, but it's also in the case of the state Senate district, it is split up from what we have right now. And it's fascinating. I mean, we're all contemplating where the radio station's located, where many immediate proximate listeners are residing, where our Congresswoman in the 45th resides, and the 45th that she has been representing, she would be residing in the 48th. So we are all really taking a look closely at this. But you're saying that it's a visualization, but if we said we wanted to be sort of linked up with other parts of the communities, more of the city of Irvine, then we trim off some other place. So there must be, I want to know, how do we find out what the data is that you've been presented with if we're not actually attending meetings? I want to know how easy it is to navigate, because navigating is a big deal from the crowdsourcing I was doing for this interview. People are all having different abilities to interpret what's going on. So I know that building that website's probably really tricky. So I know I went like 6 off-ramps here of a question about the public's ability, the accessibility to what's been said already, so that we understand why that I-5 change, what the I-5 line through Irvine, and the shift of the congressional district south, essentially.
I would just remind everybody that these are draft maps, and this is where, you know, they're meant to elicit comments and reactions and input, likes or dislikes about what we've created. If anybody goes to our website, there is, if you go to the data tab on our website, one, there is ways in which everybody can see what's current and what has been drafted. And then also within that data tab, there is also the ability to read through. At this point, I was told this morning, we have over 16,000 pieces of input on all of our maps. And this also includes all of the communities of interest testimony that we received at the beginning of the year. And so you'll see that we try to ensure that we are making decisions based on communities of interest testimony. In the case of VRA districts, that also drives what combination of communities we can put together. And so I'll just say that, for example, on the Irvine split, that was based on some communities of interest testimony. Another example is Costa Mesa, I believe, was added together within a Irvine district. I believe it was
for the congressional district.
Yeah. And again, that was also based on communities of interest testimony. But again, the draft maps are intended to create a reaction from, I'll say, residents of, you know, California, who say, why did you do this? This makes no sense at all. But to somebody else who sent us an input earlier, it made sense. And so that's why the continued inputs that we get is going to be important, because now it continues to fill out more the nuances of each of the regions, so that we can we can do our best to really look through everything and to create districts that really reflect and honor all of the six criteria, of which, again, the communities of interest input is number four, but reminding everybody that equal population, the VRA and contiguity.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So I wonder, are you aware, Commissioner Akutagawa, when people offered their input in the, we'll say, a live Zoom meeting, that it was discussed on social media that a party leader in a county would sort of become actually a member of a labor union and a local resident, that their party sort of mantle was melted away. They sort of ducked underneath that. So are you aware when people are dialing down their stature so that they don't really stick out?
Well, the way our process is set up is that any Californian can participate in the process.
Correct.
There's no requirement for any person who's giving us input to identify themselves either by title or affiliation when they call in or write to us as a commission. And we cannot ask for a person's name during public comments. So
they take advantage. It's a sort of symmetric kind of a tactic. I noticed that, you know, big deal Republicans are, you know, a business person in this county, and big deal Democrats are a labor organizer, community, you know, neighbor, something like that. So they are really trying to keep their profile down there. But I don't know, from your vantage point, you were talking about what's required of contributors not to disclose certain things. But can you, is it palpable to you that there are big deals in party politics?
I'll be honest, it's hard to tell. I mean, maybe that's my naivete. And I think that was part of the whole intent of the commission when it was created. It's
sort of 14, an equalizer.
Yeah, it's 14, you know, I want to say 14 regular people in a sense. And partisanship and political boundaries are not part of the criteria that we take into account.
So John Myers with the Los Angeles Times, he's the Sacramento bureau chief for the LA Times, last week was tweeting out a huge thread, and his final kind of offering was, I'm quoting him, "Today was a reminder that commissioners' hometowns, regions often fare a bit better," end of quote. Do you want to react to that?
You know, I believe all 14 of us have, when we go into this work, have the best intentions and the what is best for the 40 million people of California. I don't, you know, these are just draft maps right now. And I think that we all, you know, want to do what's best. And I think that in some cases, you know, what's best for California may not be best for, you know, someone's hometown.
All right. And that another observer mentioned that the changes are possible, but the larger architecture is in place. How do you respond to that?
I think right now we are looking at everything. I think there is a general architecture, but again, I think we are doing our best to try to really take into account the inputs that we're receiving. We have acknowledged also after we voted to approve the draft maps that we are very much aware that there is still work to be done on the maps. And so I don't want to say anything is set in stone because nothing is right now.
It's really amazing. It's probably, is it hard for you to measure if we're looking at the ruler, the 12-inch ruler, what inch are we at?
I mean,
it could be six. It could be 10.
Yeah, it's hard. It's really, honestly, it's really hard to say. I mean, I will say that what we're very conscious of is that if we make a change somewhere, there's going to be ripple effects to other areas of the state. And so that's why I don't want to say anything is definitive right now. I think we are, again, we want to continue to listen to what the inputs that we get from people. We know that there are some areas where we know it wasn't perfect, but we want to hear from people and we've said it out loud publicly. And based on the inputs, we're going to revisit a number of places.
Okay. Including Orange County.
Including Orange County. And I would say actually including Southern California. And I think to be fair, it would be then relooking at the entire state. And we want to make sure that we can create the fairest maps that follow the criteria that we're legally obligated to follow.
When you talked about 16,000 inputs and for 40 million people, this whole process is serving. I'm wondering if you can look back on any of these hearings. I want to know, were there any schools that were obviously participating in this exercise? Were there kids mapping with their teachers? Could you see in the sessions?
Nothing that I could point to specifically. We have heard, it's great. We will have some younger adults call in and identify themselves as a high school student
or
college student, but not always identifying
as a classroom kind of thing.
Yeah.
That would be so cool, though. I mean, I can't think of a better exercise. Everything, every kind of talent that you would need, every kind of subject to be involved, and it's happening now. It's sort of like a 10-year deal. So it's my own kind of enthralled kind of thought that what they could be using this exercise, but maybe that's how education works. You've got a required a curriculum and it doesn't let you bring in a redistricting exercise. So there.
Yeah. And I think you're absolutely right. You know, I'd like to mention that we do actually have a curriculum that was developed with a school district in Sacramento. There is a curriculum, a high school curriculum that was developed about redistricting so that we can engage young adults.
Right. I mean, because it explains if there is a lesson on nuance and the need for all kinds of subject mastery, this would be the exercise that has an impact for 10 years on 40 million and growing people.
Yeah. Like imagine, right? You're a high school senior. I mean, 10 years from now, this is very much going to be, you know, something that's going to be important to them. Or even if you're a high school junior and you're 17 years old, these lines are going to impact them.
And brings along some habitual voting as another dividend. That's mm-hmm. always the pie.
Yeah. You know, Claudia, can I just mention one other thing to you? And I just want to make it clear that redistricting, one, is a constitutionally mandated exercise. There's no opting out for a city to opt out. Secondly, redistricting does not mean that a city moves from one county to another. I think there's been some misunderstanding about what redistricting is about, and there seems to be, based on some of the comments that we've received or inputs that we've received, that there's concern about if a Orange County city were to be, let's say, put into an electoral district with, let's say, some cities in LA County or even Riverside or San Bernardino or even San Diego County, that it means that they're changing counties, and they're not.
That's strange. People are saying that?
Well, that is some of the inputs that I've seen that we've received. And so I just want to make sure that, you know, people understand that a city does not leave Orange County. It just means you're in a different electoral district. So your electoral representation, you know, who you're affiliated with may be a little bit different, but Seal Beach will not become LA County.
Right. Or the Inland Empire doesn't go north. Exactly. Wow, that's interesting.
Yorba Linda will not become part of Riverside or something like that.
And that is why civics is so essential that people, I mean, I would never have thought that that would change the local government boundaries at all. It's a whole different overlay. But if people are having problem with that, we have a big civics lesson hanging over us for the hall. So
I just mentioned that. In case there's some misinformation, I just wanted to be clear that those are some aspects of redistricting that I think are important for everyone to understand.
Well, I can't ask for more time other than I want to exact from you, would you be willing to do a whole wrap-up interview in 2022 about this whole process? I mean, you're going to be serving for 9 more years, but would you be willing to come back and tell us how it all wrapped up for you sometime later? Let's give you maybe after January. Would you be willing? Okay.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to come back and speak with you again on post-maps, I guess.
Post-maps, and we could bring Pastor Turner from Stockton. I know she's been involved with that San Joaquin drama. So you can bring she can bring her San Joaquin, you can bring your Orange County drama, and we'll do that. Well, thank you, Commissioner Akutagawa, for your service and for taking the time away from commission meeting just right now for yet another round of mapping process with our listeners.
Thank you.
My guest was Commissioner Linda Akutagawa of Huntington Beach, one of 14 commissioners serving on the California Citizens Redistricting Commission. Thanks again.
Thank you.
We'll be right back with atmospheric science Shahir Masri, who will be taking stock of COP26 in Glasgow, bringing it down to the local level. Be right back. Don't go away.
Welcome back to the show. Well, the International Convention on Climate, COP26, having concluded in Glasgow, October 31st through November 12th, meant I had to nab Shahir Masri for perspective. Shahir returns bringing his climate science researcher, lecture activist, and author credentials to examine the maneuverings in Glasgow and give us, you guessed it, assignments. Shahir is an assistant specialist in air pollution exposure assessment and epidemiology at UC Irvine, where he works on air pollution exposure modeling as well as climate change communication research. He's also an adjunct faculty member at Chapman University, where he teaches courses on environmental health and pollution, and an adjunct faculty member at National University, where he teaches online graduate and undergraduate science courses. Currently, he's investigating exposure to harmful combustion-related air pollutants in the U.S. and China. He's the author of the book Beyond Debate, Answers to 50 Misconceptions on Climate Change, and is also the author of numerous articles. He's co-founded a project called On the Road for Climate Action, which was an effort to raise awareness about climate change by organizing educational climate events and giving public presentations across 50 states. And that is perhaps a manual for following up the mighty meeting in Glasgow. Before I welcome back on the show, I want to make it official. Congratulations on tying the knot with Athena, your partner in not a crime, but a rescue. Congratulations, Shahir.
Oh, well, thank you so much. That's so nice. And it's great to be back on the show.
Thank you. Shahir comes to us today from his office in Orange. Welcome right back to Ask a Leader, Shahir.
Thank you. Thank you. Happy to be here talking about such an important issue.
Well, let's start with necessary and sufficient tests measured at the UN Climate Change Conference of the Parties, COP26, the UN forum, measures you advise us to apply toward gauging the success of this meeting. What are those measures you would apply?
You know, I think we always want to see rigorous commitments come out of these summits. So obviously the types of commitments that are made are an important barometer. And we also want to see, you know, how many countries or which countries are signing on to those. We had a no-show of China, which is obviously important. But I think
And Russia.
Yeah, I think that when you're bringing in this many nations to tackle such an important issue, the types of things we want to see happen and the concrete kinds of commitments, they're oftentimes watered down. You've got competing interests, different countries in different economic stages of development. We saw some of that play out on the stage there with a sort of disappointing plea by India in the 11th hour there, which we can talk about. But by and large, I think those are the kind of things we need to pay attention to. And whether or not this was a success is still difficult to say, because it's really about how much of this is applied and how countries actually roll things out moving forward that's going to be so important. And that's kind of what we saw after Paris 5 years ago as well.
So my casual read of this, because there are lots of trains to keep track of right now. This is one of the biggest trains, of course, and we all need to be attending to. But my take was that the fossil fuel suits were there. Is it palpable to you that they were even more present than they've ever been before? Maybe they never had to go to too many meetings before because they locked commitments up from representatives before the forum even began. So what's your understanding, Shahir, of the dynamic of fossil fuel lobbyists at COP26?
You know, I think fossil fuel lobbyists are always going to be at these types of important events. I mean, there is such a stakeholder in this issue. That being said, COP26 was the first ever international climate pact to explicitly reference fossil fuels. So we did see progress in that regard. So in some ways, this was the most kind of important COP with respect to curbing fossil fuel emissions. And I think that we can at least see that as a win. We did not get to, unfortunately, see stronger language with respect to phasing out coal, but there was progress made. And in fact, during the process of this summit, as you likely know, the US and China, despite China not being officially part of this, had a joint agreement to work on reducing methane emissions, which is another sort of positive on this front. But again, all this really comes down to what actual steps are taken moving forward.
So does it matter if all countries are present, or is that a kind of a sideshow that maybe eyes over here on the drafts, the figures, the stats and all that?
You know, my perspective on these types of summits is that it's really important who's at the table. And when we've seen the United States abstain from important summits, it's a real strong signal to the international community that one of the largest emitters of greenhouse gas emissions, huge economy, is not taking an issue seriously. So to see, that from China and Russia, I think those do send important signals about the still reluctance that some countries have as it relates to kind of conforming to this aggressive greenhouse gas emissions necessity. But with that being said, just like we saw during the 4 years of the Trump administration, we know that even in the absence of the United States, for instance, the signal that the world has understood is that climate change is accelerating and we've got to do everything we can to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So we can still expect the trajectory to move in the positive direction, despite the China and Russia not being present at COP26, just as we got to see governors and state leaders and other countries still rally during the course of the Trump administration to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, you bring up India already, and India was there, but as you said, at the 11th hour, sort of lowered the performance standard on the goalposts setting at COP26.
That's right. There was a lot of enthusiasm about the fact that, language in COP26 was talking about phasing out coal. Unfortunately, again, in the 11th hour there, India wanted to have that language changed to phase down coal. And now some people, depending on who you talk to, see that as a huge loss. You know, we've heard quotes throughout the summit from some of the low-lying nations, in one case saying that failure to really curb greenhouse gas emissions is essentially a death sentence for their country. Some of these countries that, especially island nations, that are literally facing being wiped off the map. So this was viewed in large part as a disappointment by a lot of people in the international community. But there's also those that we heard from after the summit that saw that difference to be not so significant, that, you know, some people quoted as saying the signal is clear, kind of like I mentioned a second ago. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I do believe the signal is clear. And really what's more important than whether the language says phase out or phase down is, again, what countries actually choose to do. And I think the countries that recognize the importance of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, countries that are already not favorable to coal and are looking to phase coal out, are still going to move forward in that trajectory. You know, like I said, we're still seeing some countries dig their heels in as we move forward to greenhouse gas emissions reductions. And we just saw that unfortunately play out in a big way. It's unclear as to how that'll, you know, what the implications will be there, but you know, it's kind of mixed depending on who you talk to. And I think the signal really is clear that coal is on its way out, and a big piece of phasing it out entirely, you know, and helping countries to do the same is going to be how much assistance financially countries like the United States are willing to give to other countries that are looking to comply with, you know, these sort of treaties. And those kinds of issues still remain to be ironed out.
Well, with the same kind of stakeholder dynamic of fossil fuels present at COP26, their assets and the status quo that's keeping them, that's enriching them. So they're defending a status quo for their functioning, as well as the assets that COP26 would be trying to tap into to spread around for adaptation and mitigation and other ways of turning down this whole load of greenhouse gases everywhere. So it's the same coin. I don't know which side of the coin it is, you know, exacting those fees to move forward with protecting those places that are just about underwater.
Yeah. So despite their having requested that language change, India, which is one of the biggest consumers of coal, still did pledge to reach net zero emissions by 2070. So this, of course, means that they'll no longer add greenhouse gases from that emission source by that.
So every time somebody says net zero, I'm going to hold on to my checkbook. I'm going to hold on to my first, second born. You know, that net zero is theater. It doesn't give us what we really need to turn all greenhouse gases down everywhere. It's just moving them around.
Yes. I mean, I see what you're saying. If it depends on how that net zero is, it depends how real the net zero is, right? So if it's just if it's just planting a few seeds, you know, planting trees and not really following up on that, of course, that's not what we need to see. You know, we need to see true net zero and ultimately cutting of greenhouse gas emissions entirely and reforesting or afforestation. That's going to be the kind of progress. Those are going to be the measures of progress we really need to see.
I guess when I hear net zero, I'm going to use a ridiculous analogies. If this is a soccer game, I'm going to bring a brown card. So the referee, every time somebody says net zero, the brown card flips out on the field. So just to slow everybody down and be intellectually honest with our accounting of greenhouse gas emissions. So that's what I'm going to do, is use my brown card from now on when I hear that, with or without radio.
We needed you in the audience there at the summit.
Well, we got the blah, blah, blah. I mean, right. I'm sure that's a hashtag. It's a GIF. I'm sure it's a meme by now. Thank you, Greta. Tusen Dank. So speaking of brown cards flipping and greenwashing, so the Biden administration was talking out of like three corners of their mouth with trying to lead again. We're back after the previous administration's withdrawal from the Paris meeting. So there's the leadership card they're playing, and there's the infrastructure investment bill that was signed into law today. We're recording this the day before the broadcast. November 15th. And then there's also the matter that he is signing leases for an estimated 80 million acres producing 1.1 billion with a B barrels of oil, 4.4 trillion with a T cubic feet of natural gas over several decades. So that's not getting us that goal.
No, and I think that, you know, seeing if we could rewind during the when we had candidates running for US presidency, Biden's plan was not the most aggressive climate action plan that
and it was named, it was called out at the time.
Right, exactly. And we knew that Warren and Bernie Sanders had much stronger climate action plans, and Bernie Sanders in particular. What we're seeing from Joe Biden is a little bit of a centrist approach to climate mitigation. And in my opinion, we do need to see more aggressive action.
So that was a marred leadership profile then that he brought to COP26. So the U.S. is contributing to undermining what could have been more ambitious kinds of, I want to say, aspirations, not to mention goals.
Right. I think so. And, you know, we've got to do more than come up with plans to reduce methane and do more than, you know, talk about improving automobile fuel efficiency standards and phase out coal in the United States. There's really a lot more to be done. And we often tend to fall short of the sort of ambitions that we do concretely make, the commitments that we make. So when we make sort of soft or mild commitments, it's just really not enough. We're committing essentially by doing that to very little action. So I'm always favoring more aggressive commitments. And if we fall short, at least we've gotten somewhere significant.
So Shahir, were there developments that surprised you? And we are going to get assignments, but I'm just going to sort of keep getting Shahir's perspective on what was done. So to what hasn't already been said, and there will be more said because we're only days away from the closing of the conference, of the forum. But some indicators that you thought, well, I didn't see that coming, or that you thought maybe there was a different kind of dynamic, maybe more reverence to people that were saying, hey, we're just about totally inundated where we are in our Pacific Island, our Indian Ocean stretches.
I think a lot of what came out of this conference was a sense of really heightened urgency that was underscored. So there was there was a bit of a departure. So the COP original Paris Agreement and summit was criticized in some ways for not really strongly enough discussing the science and basically reflecting the urgency of the science. And in this summit, we did see more of a, you know, basically endorsement and acknowledgement of the recent IPCC report, which talks about the potential irreversible impact, you know, and also the potential consequences of sea level rise and, you know, real major climate-related catastrophe. That was a real theme of the current summit. And in many ways, that was the sort of major soft difference that we saw between the two. And that's, I think, what a lot of people noticed coming out of this. Some of the quotes actually that came out of this conference, I think, get right at the heart of that. So, you know, we heard from the president of the...
Tuvalu?
Yeah. It was...
He was amazing.
Yeah, there were a couple. So UN Secretary Antonio Guterres mentioned, you know, our fragile planet is hanging by a thread and we're still knocking on the door of climate catastrophe. It is time to go into emergency mode, he said. So this is quite in line with what we've been hearing from, you know, the science talking about climate change. We heard that from Shamara, this was the COP26 president, that basically we can say with credibility that we've kept 1.5 degrees alive, and this is talking about, you know, the COP26 summit, but quote, its pulse is weak and it'll only survive if we keep our promises and translate commitments into rapid action. So that's getting right at the core of, you know, the commitment. Okay, is good. It's there. It's not excellent, but it's there. But it's still, you know, it's not enough until we've actually seen actions take place. And really, that's where it's really starting at the close of the summit that all the important, you know, not to undermine, of course.
And that's always been the way. It's been with every single COP forum that, okay, we're getting there. But that's where you want the best possible circumstances to take it home. If you just joined us, my guest is Shahir Masri, is an air quality researcher, and he's looking at what was achieved or not achieved at COP26 in Glasgow these last several weeks. Now, I want to get assignments from you in the time remaining. This is going to be a short segment, everybody, but we have to get our jobs from Shahir. So international to the national, and we're going to zoom to the local here. I didn't appreciate where there was a local California assemblyman saying, well, that was COP, but I'm doing my local thing, cleaning up the beach. And I thought that was absolute ridiculousness. So what meaningful local kind of activation would you suggest for all of us?
Yeah, I think what you said is a great point. And I'm going to just kind of add on top of that. And this is coming from somebody who's, you know, eco-minded, and I do the best things I can as a consumer to avoid adverse impacts of the environment. If you hear this podcast and you hear the discussions of COP26 and you think to yourself that, you know, you're doing your part by bringing reusable bags to the grocery store, avoiding plastic bottles, saying no to straws at the restaurants, that's just not enough. It's not sufficient. In fact, most of what I just described is not relating really at the greenhouse gas problem, the greenhouse gas emissions issue. So those are all excellent things to do to try to reduce your environmental footprint. But we really are talking about something much more substantial that requires a whole host of different actions that are at a different sort of level. So we're talking about really thinking carefully about how you use energy in your household, talking about turning down your heater in the, and these are not things that are really asking that much. So, you know, turning down your thermostat by a degree in the wintertime, you know, so that your heater's not running all night, putting a sweater on maybe when it's a little cold. Similarly, in the summertime, air conditioners, oh my God, they're just constantly running everywhere I go. And especially when you leave the house, turn off the air conditioning. These are really low hanging fruit that we can all do. Diet is so important. I talk about diet when I give presentations on climate change. Yeah. And this is a really easy way that we can help to reduce our environmental and climate and carbon footprint. Eating more plant-based foods. This is going to be a really important part as a global society of really grappling with the climate change issue. If we see the entire world aspire to have the US diet, frankly, we're not going to defeat this issue. We're not going to really overcome environmental catastrophe because it is simply not sustainable the way that we eat in this country. So we've really got to see, I think, a culture shift. I'm not saying everyone needs to be a vegan or a vegetarian, but reducing our consumption of animal products is really going to be an important way to really help protect the environment, protect the climate. As you know, Amazon rainforest, leading cause of deforestation is not building houses and roads and creating lumber for construction, but it's actually just to raise animals to raise livestock essentially for our diets. Other important things that we can do include, you know, transportation and air travel and things of that nature. So thinking about using less gas, you don't have to convert to a bicycle. It's not necessarily practical for everyone. Of course, I'm an advocate of that sort of thing, but thinking more carefully about how you use your vehicle. If you've got to go to the grocery store, write down a list of all the things you need so that you don't have to go back there in 2 days. And you can write in that simple measure, you can actually cut your grocery store related fossil fuel emissions by half. And these are really direct ways that you as an individual are contributing greenhouse gases to the atmosphere right through your tailpipe. So it's just really important to think of your tailpipe as if you're polluting your own child's air, because that's kind of what we're doing. So let's try to minimize that.
Shahir, I'm going to close with admonishing all of us to go for higher hanging fruit, reconsider every kind of voting measure, every candidate we're supporting. Look electorally who's supporting improving the performance standards of how everything is operating, and understanding the producer responsibility in the final analysis, the counting of greenhouse gas emissions. It's the front of the pipe, not the end of the pipe where the consumers are. I want to put that up there. I know you believe that, but I just didn't hear that. So I'm going to say that in our conclusion. My guest. And so any last local assignments that we haven't covered in this short segment we're doing, and we'll talk more about COP26 later, but I had to tack it on while people still had this fresh in their minds. Anything else, Shahir?
You know, I think just what you said. So we were talking about COP26 and sort of the carbon footprints and commitments of different nations. So my head was kind of in that carbon footprint space. But actually, when I give talks and talk to communities about climate change mitigation, I put forth three pillars. And in fact, the pillar of carbon footprint I actually put last as the third pillar. Still really important, one of the top three. But as you noted, civic duty is actually what I label as my number one thing that you can do, and easy to do as well. Go vote. Like you said, go vote for people who support a for one thing, acknowledge the importance of climate change and the human role in climate change, but also have a plan to move us forward towards climate action. And then actually number two of the three pillars that I discussed, it's actually outreach and communication, because it's not sufficient to have your own commitment to climate action. We've really got to spiderweb this so that our neighbors and friends and colleagues are aware of the importance of climate action, the catastrophe of potential climate change. And that means also being a role model in your community. If you drive an electric car, don't be shy to tell your neighbor, your friend, your family members why it is you bought that electric car. If in fact it has to do with climate change and sustainability, be proud of it, be a role model. One of the most important ways that people formulate opinions is actually by the opinions of their close family, their close
peer friends. Pressure. Well, Shahir, we don't have more time. We bit off a big bite here to chew on. But I just want to thank you for coming for this installment for COP26 on Ask a Leader Today. Thank you for showing up again.
It's my pleasure. Thanks. Always happy to come back.
My guest was Shahir Masri, air quality researcher, author, climate change activist, and he'll be back again, folks. Thanks again, Shahir.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's a wrap here, folks. And for the next week, we're going to have Thanksgiving, Thanksgiving themes, you know. Ladies and gentlemen, talk with you next week. Thank you for listening, everyone.